This is Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. According to the American Cancer Society, the most common cancers in women in descending order of frequency are breast, colon, uterine, lung, cervical, skin, and ovarian. So three of the top seven cancers are gynecological, meaning they involve the female reproductive tract. Ovarian cancer is the fifth leading cause of cancer death in women, and cervical cancer is a leading cause of death in women globally. Joining me today in the studio to discuss the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of gynecologic cancers is gynecologic oncologist Dr. Joni Mayer Hope of Alaska Women's Cancer Care. Among her many activities, Dr. Mayer Hope is also president of Let Every Woman Know, a grassroots community organization that is focused on increasing awareness of gynecologic cancers. Because all of that's apparently not enough to keep her off the streets, she's also vocalist in the Ned Band, a rock group made up of gynecologic oncologists. Welcome, Dr. Mayer Hope, to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Dr. Mayer Hope, let's start with a discussion about your medical practice. One of the last programs I hosted, we talked about careers in medicine and how people end up doing the various types of practices they do. So tell us a little about your training and what's involved in becoming a gynecologic oncologist.
Well, a gynecologic oncologist is sort of a unique breed of a doctor because the philosophy behind women's cancer care below the belt cancers is one of comprehensive care. So we are trained in both the surgical aspects as well as the medical aspects of the diseases that we treat. You start out, as with any medical career in medical school, and then we go on into a four-year residency in OBGYN, and from there subspecialize into gynecologic oncology with either a three- or four-year fellowship, during which time you learn about how to take care of, for example, ovarian cancer, both surgically, chemotherapy, end-of-life care, comprehensive care, so that when a woman comes to you with a cancer diagnosis or with concern for a cancer diagnosis, that essentially that woman becomes a patient potentially for the remainder of her life.
So how did you get interested in gynecologic oncology?
Well, I actually came to being a doctor later than most do. I didn't go to medical school until I was 30 years old. And once I got into medicine, my motivations for becoming a doctor were really about working on the issues that I cared most deeply about, which were issues of access and equity, social justice issues, access to care. And that was my guiding principle about why I wanted to enter into the healthcare field. I really didn't have a preconceived notion about what kind of doctor I would want to be. Once I got into medical school and got access to the different subspecialties, I was extremely taken with OBGYN, partially because of the range of care that you can provide, from really upfront primary care all the way to extreme emergencies. And then once I entered OBGYN, it was just an absolute fit when I started to have exposure to gynecologic oncology and see the depth of the relationships involved, the depth of the intellectual stimulation that was necessary and knowledge base that was required to really understand, and also the surgical side of it, the very, you know, applied, practical application of the tools of medicine.
So the challenge of both the cognitive skills needed to be an oncologist, as well as the surgical skills needed, the ability to work with your hands, sound like they were attractants for you to pursue this particular branch of medicine.
As well as the emotional and the psychological side of the connection that it takes to find that relationship with somebody who's fighting a disease that could be threatening her life, and figuring out how to be a guide and a partner in that journey with her and with her family and with her supporters in a way that brings all of those challenges together and making good choices for her care with her.
Well, Dr. Mayor Hope, for a number of years, I believe you were the only gynecologic oncologist in Alaska. You now have a partner, and you're not alone. How did you wind up in Alaska?
Well, I certainly didn't intend to become the only gynecologic oncologist in Alaska. I did my medical training in New York City, both medical school, my residency, and my fellowship, so 12 years in New York City. But I came from Colorado. I grew up in Colorado. But I hadn't lived in the mountains since I was a child. So by the time I finally was ready to launch as a gynecologic oncologist and look for that first job, I was ready for basically an enormous change. And I had had the opportunity my fourth year of medical school to spend a month in Metlakatla through the Indian Health Services and had a very amazing and very different experience of healthcare and medicine than I had in inner city Brooklyn where I had been doing my medical school. And while it was not gynecologic oncology, it was primary care that I had exposure to there, the absolute beauty of Alaska just resonated with me. So 8 years later, when I was ready to look for a job, I got very curious about how cancer was taken care of, how gynecologic cancers were taken care of in Alaska. And I basically reached out to see, is there a gynecologic oncologist in Alaska? And at that time, there was one. Her name was Dr. Ruth Higdon, and she was a very interesting woman, fascinating and phenomenal in her own right. And essentially, I pestered her until she provided me with an interview, and at which point I fell in love with the idea of coming up here and convinced her that she needed a partner. So she hired me to join her in 2010. And my daughter, who was 3 years old at the time, and I together, the two of us, moved here. But shortly thereafter, she had some situations in her life that led to her leaving the state very shortly, like as in a month after her. That's very shortly. So there I was, literally out of my fellowship training, finding myself as the only gynecologic oncologist in the state. And thankfully, the incredible support of the medical community here is in large part what enabled me to, you know, decide to swim and grow and develop now what is a really robust women's cancer care approach that we have here in the state.
All right. Well, just as a reminder, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media, talking today with Dr. Joni Mayer Hope about gynecologic cancers. And we welcome you to join in the conversation by calling us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you're in the Anchorage area, the local number is 550-8433. So, Dr. Mayer Hope, there are not many gynecologic oncologists, and there are not many physicians who play in rock bands. You are both. Tell us about the NED band.
Well, NED, NED stands for No Evidence of Disease. And we are, in fact, an indie rock band made up of gynecologic oncologists. We've been together 10 years. And we have four CDs. We've performed all over the country. We've raised all of the music that we do is in the benefit of gynecologic cancer causes. And over the course of our 10-year trajectory as a band, you know, we've raised, you know, close to $2 million for the cause. And remarkably, for any rock and roll band, regardless of what they're made up of, you know, we're still standing and we're still playing. I'm the only person in Alaska, obviously, in the band. The rest of us are scattered throughout the lower 48. And we get together about six times a year and or more. We've had, I think, almost 10 concerts in 2018. And we perform in rock and roll venues, you know, in conjunction with usually a cause that both benefits the local community as well as the national gynecologic cancer cause.
Wow. So let's listen to a clip. One of your recent releases was Life As It Was. Dave, can we listen to a little bit of the Ned Band, please? And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. That was a clip from the Ned Band, Life as It Was. And if you download that entire piece, which is available from iTunes, it features later in the piece a guitar vocal by Tom Morello. Now,
guitar solo, right?
Guitar solo, yeah, sorry about that. I obviously don't talk about music very much. So, Dr. Mayer, hope in medical research and in public health, we're all about force multipliers and collaboration, but a physician joining forces with a veteran of Rage Against the Machine and Audio Slave is a bit of an outlier. So how did that collaboration come about?
Well, this is a really exciting opportunity for us because Tom Morello is truly one of the great guitar players of all time. However, he's also has a history of having gone to Harvard University and happened to be roommates with our bass player, Bob Berger. And they were in a band together in college. And while Tom Morello went pro musician, Bob Morello went pro gynecologic oncologist. And
it's an interesting career choice.
I'm not sure if our bass player thinks he made the right choice or not in retrospect. I'm sure he does. At any rate, once we realized that he had this friendship, the rest of the band sort of asked Bob to ask Tom Morello if he would be willing to do a solo on a song with us. And so we presented him with this song. The vocal you heard is our other vocalist, Dr. John Bogus, who's in North Carolina. And he said, sure, he'd be happy to. So that's the most recent song that we've recorded. It's a single. It's available on all the usual spots, Spotify, you know, Amazon, Apple Music, et cetera, iTunes. And as I said, you know, all of the music is a benefit for the cause.
Great. And that is an important point, that this is a benefit for the cause. And you can download Life as It Was from iTunes. On my iPhone, it's on right next to the App Store, from which you can also download the AK app and stream this program and listen to past shows as well. I actually noticed it also includes the various choices for downloading or streaming includes Napster. I didn't even realize that Napster is still a thing. So anyway, getting off topic here, but I'm sure we can edit this out. So moving along. No, actually, Dave says we're live. This is live radio. Can't edit that out. So let's reorient here and move on to a discussion about gynecologic cancers. Dr. Mayer Hope, when I think of gynecologic cancers, I think of uterine cancer is the most common, ovarian cancer is the most deadly, and then cervical cancer is maybe the bright spot in terms of it being the most preventable. And it's an area where there's been tremendous progress in the United States during the 20th century. So let's actually start with just a little bit of anatomy here for daytime radio. If I were not a physician as a man, this might sound like a discussion of parts unknown. So before we talk about cervical cancer, let's start with what is a cervix?
Great question. Well, the cervix is essentially the mouth of the uterus. It's the gateway or the opening of the uterus. It's part of the uterus. It's not a distinct organ from the uterus. It's positioned at the top of the vagina, and it is the part of the uterus that expands and dilates prior to a woman giving birth and enables, you know, baby to pass through the birth canal. The cervix is composed of two types of cells. The outer cells are called squamous cells, That's also called the ectocervix. And then the inner part of the cervix is called the endocervix, and those are glandular cells. And the cervix is at particular risk for cancers that are HPV-related or human papillomavirus-related. And in fact, cervical cancer is one of the types of cancers, the few cancers that are sexually transmitted, if you will. Because HPV, the virus HPV, is a virus that is ubiquitous, by which I mean every single person who is sexually active is exposed to HPV. There's no prevention of being exposed to HPV. You're going to be exposed to HPV if you are a sexually active person. So because of the particular makeup of the cervix, where you have both this squamous and this glandular interface, it makes it a particularly fertile ground for HPV virus to take hold and to lie dormant. And because it is a virus, over time, when times are more stressful or when women's immune systems may be lower, you can develop changes in that cervix. And they start out as precancerous changes, but if gone unchecked, they can develop into cancerous changes, which becomes cervical cancer.
So a question that I oftentimes get as having worked in public health and as an infectious disease provider is, when will there be a vaccine to prevent cancer? And here's a case where we actually do have a vaccine that prevents cancer. And of course, the human papillomaviruses are a huge family of viruses that virtually everyone is infected with one strain or another. These are the same large group of viruses that cause common warts as well, but also genital warts. But
and oropharyngeal cancers.
And oropharyngeal cancers as well. In fact, it's been estimated that roughly 39,000 HPV-related cases of cancer occur every year. The majority are cervical cancer, but also oropharyngeal cancer, as well as other types of genital cancer as well.
Penile cancer, anal cancer, cervical cancer, vaginal cancer, vulvar cancer, just to list those, as well as the oropharyngeal cancers. There's over 150 types of HPV and 40 different types that will infect the genital tract alone. It's the most common sexually transmitted disease that's out there.
Right. And vaccination is now recommended routinely for girls and boys beginning at age 11 to 12, which gives some parents a little bit of heartburn since we're talking about an infection that can be sexually transmitted. But it's in part because the vaccine works best for lifelong immunity when given at that age.
It's recommended at age 11. It's actually FDA approved younger than that.
Yes.
Okay.
And it can also be given older people as well.
All the way as now. The FDA indication has recently expanded all the way up to the age of 45. Actually, you know, like any vaccine, it's essential that you give it prior. It's not essential, but it is most effective
before you're exposed.
Exactly, prior to the exposure. It's sort of like if you're riding a bike, and if you you want to prevent a head injury, you want to put the helmet on before you get on the bike, right? If you put the helmet on after you've fallen off the bike and hit in your head, it defeats the purpose.
Yeah, but I see somebody riding a bike without a helmet. I think they must be the smartest person in the world because somehow they know when they're going to fall off and need to put that helmet on. It just really doesn't work that way. And of course, the other advantage of vaccinating earlier is before age 15, two doses of vaccine rather than three immunogenic.
The HPV vaccine now covers 9 different strains of HPV, the most dangerous strains that are the most common to cause cancer. And if you do get it before the age of 15, then you only need to get it twice, once, and it's 6 months apart. And that provides lifelong immunity. And it's essentially you can prevent a terrible cancers, a terrible group of cancers with two shots for your children.
It's a remarkable progress. Let's talk about The screening for cervical cancer. That's a tool that's been in our public health toolbox and clinical medicine toolbox for a number of years now, with the PAP screen, also short for Papanicolaou screening. Also more recently, there may be a role even of screening for human papillomavirus infection. But let's talk about what are the current recommendations, who should be screened and how often?
Well, that is a moving target, actually.
That's why I asked you.
You know, the challenge with PAP screening and it is that you want to screen for a precancer before it becomes a cancer, where you can then take action to prevent the cancer. But you don't want to screen so early that you actually are causing interventions and surgical procedures, for example, on young women who might otherwise clear the infection on their own. So, actually, routine Pap smear screening is not recommended for women under the age of 20. Or 25 even at this point, that because we've found that if you just wait it out, even if you have an HPV infection, that many times that HPV infection will be cleared by the woman's own immune system. So at this point in time, you can still get a regular Pap smear, which is basically a brush of the cell of the cells that are right at the apex of the vagina, at the cervix, looking for abnormal cells. You can also do that in conjunction with an HPV test, where they look to see whether there's the high-risk strains of HPV present. And now even the recommendation is evolving where you can simply do an HPV test standalone without the PAP test itself. Now, how often that's done and the frequency and that's done, I could go over those details if you want, but I can tell you now that depending on the combination of those things, you would do it every 3 to 5 years. Okay, whether it's done just an HPV test or whether it's done with a Pap smear, and that your gynecologist is the person to speak to about when you need to start your Pap test and or your HPV screening and how frequently you need to do it based on the results of that test.
Great. Thank you. So we're going to go to a short break. We'll be right back in a minute and continue our discussion of gynecologic cancers with Dr. Joni Mayer-Hope. This is Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska reminds residents that open enrollment is now through December 15th. CMS studies indicate 90% of Alaskans qualified for a tax credit in 2017. Enroll at premera.com. This message sponsored by Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Butler, and my guest today is Dr. Joni Mayer-Hope of Alaska Women's Cancer Care. So we've been talking about cervical cancer, but let's move on and talk about other types of gynecologic cancers. But before we get into specific organ systems, let's talk a little bit about Let Every Woman Know. That was I think, how I first met you a few years back, Joni, was through Let Every Woman Know. Tell us about your work in that group and the partnership with community organizations that you have, as well as the events that you have.
Well, Let Everyone Know is a nonprofit that's based in Alaska. It's completely dedicated to raising awareness about gynecologic cancers and providing support services and educational services throughout the state. We started Let Every Woman Know in 2013. And since that time, we've grown into a number of really amazing programs in support of women survivors and women going through the disease process, fighting gynecologic cancers. Just to give you a sort of a small overview of what we do, every February, the first weekend of February, we have an Arts of Healing Weekend, which is really a conference, if you will, but it's a celebration as well. It starts out with a First Friday art show, and that this year that will be on February 1st at the Georgia Blue Gallery from 5 to 8 p.m., and it's intersections of art and cancer, and it's really an amazing event and a reception in conjunction with the First Friday events that happen around the city, where you can see amazing art that really touches to the core of the cause. Creativity, art, music, and other forms of creativity is really a central part of the mission of Let Everyone Know. The weekend then goes on to a two-day conference where we bring in out-of-state speakers, truly phenomenal scientists and doctors who are world premier experts in their fields, whether it's genetics or immunotherapy, bringing the state-of-the-art education to Alaska. That is, they give talks both that are at the provider level with CME credit for that, continuing medical education credit, as well as for our patients and their families. It's completely free to attend. This year, we have 8 fantastic speakers coming. Then on Saturday night, we have our requisite rock and roll concert, of course. And this year, we're bringing in the band Mipso, which is just a fantastic indie bluegrass-flavored band of national rapport, really accomplished, that are coming in to play for our concert is the Rhythm Heals concert. We also several years ago, changed the name of the concert to the Dance Like Barb Rhythm Heals annual show in honor of Barb Earp, who is a patient of mine who helped us found the organization, ovarian cancer. That's our annual February event. We also do a memorial for the women who we've lost the previous year, recognizing the harder part of this journey. But in addition to the annual conference that we have, Let Everyone Know provides support group services, survivor retreats, services for supporters of our cancer patients. We've now for 5 years have a group called the Extra Toughs, which stands for Extraordinary Transformation Towards GYN Health and Survivorship. Yes, I had to work hard on that acronym. Extra Toughs, and it's an obesity cancer intervention. It's a 3-month dedicated exercise program that integrates nutritional counseling, psychological support, and exercise training with our cancer survivors who also are battling with weight, as there's many interactions between obesity and cancer, and gynecologic cancers in particular. So that's an example of something we do. We have a dance team called Team Thrive, which is a hip-hop dance team, hip-hop dancers touched by cancer, which is really brings together both family members and women going through it and men who are touched by the cause, people who are in the healthcare field themselves. We're in our third year of Team Thrive. The Alyaska Climathon is in September, which is Gynecologic Cancer Awareness Month, and Let Everyone Know is in partnership with the Alyaska Climathon to raise funding for gynecologic cancer every single year at that event. These are just a subset of what we do. We're launching several really amazing new programs right now. And the way that this happens is through the phenomenal support of our medical community, who have year after year donated incredibly generously to allow Let Everyone Know to exist and to continue to grow.
All right. So I'm impressed you're getting MIPSO. A lot of activities occurring around the state. I want to raise a question that we received by email. We discussed a bit cervical cancer screening, when to start, at what age. The question is from a listener who is in her 70s, and she's wondering how often she should be screened. She had heard every 3 to 5 years, but she just was wondering if that's still accurate. What are the recommendations for older women?
It depends whether you've ever had an abnormal pap smear before or you've ever had a history of cervical cancer or precancer. There, if you have had a history of HPV related disease in your vagina, vulva, or cervix, then you would need to continue screening. So, but if you haven't, then there is an age at which you can generally stop, but it is important to talk to her actual doctor about that to make sure that she's clear about what when it is okay.
And it, as always, our bottom line is do talk with your provider. So that sounds like, I hope that's helpful to that listener. And I'd also like to take a call. We have a caller from Eagle River. Welcome, Nicole, to Line 1, your health connection.
Hello, doctor. Hey, yes. My mother took stilbestrol when she was 16, and she ended up with cervical cancer. And I was always told and have had annual pap smears since I was 16 to check. They've all come clean. I'm 38 now, but I have had multiple fibroadenomas in my breasts, and I've heard that it does continue on to the two daughters, and I've also heard that it does not continue on to daughters, the risk, the increased risk of cancer. I was wondering if you had any more recent information on that.
All right. Dr. Mayer Hope, any thoughts on this?
There can be increased risk of different gynecologic problems, both in the women who took stilbestrol and also in daughters. It's not your typical type of HPV-related cervical cancer that we're talking about. So I would again, say that you need to have a doctor who can take a proper history and understand, explain to you, based on your own history, what the best steps are.
Yes, yeah, I've been moved on to every 3 years now since my paps have always been clean. So just was seeing if there was any other new information on dihalyl stilbestrol and I can never pronounce it, but yeah, stilbestrol.
Yeah, the type of cancers that are associated are a slightly different type of cancers. There's also what happens with some of the daughters was that there is some actual anatomic variation in their anatomy that was found that could predispose them to more problems. So related to preterm delivery and things like that. So it sounds like you're really on top of it, and that, you know, there's, as long as you have an OBGYN who you can really talk it through with and make sure you're getting the proper screening. But the actual pap smear recommendations that are related to HPV would hold true for you.
Okay.
Well, all right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Nicole, thank you for joining us live on Line 1, your health connection, even if I forget we're live. So, Dr. Mayer Hope, let's move on and talk a bit about uterine cancer. Last week's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, also known as the MMWR, leads with a paper on uterine cancer and points out that it's one of the few cancers of increasing incidence and death rates in the United States. And it's now, depending on how you cut the data, the third or fourth most common cancer diagnosed in women in the U.S. and the seventh most common cause of cancer death. So tell us about uterine cancer. What is it, and what are the symptoms that women should be alert for?
So uterine cancer, when people say that, they generally are speaking about a cancer we call endometrial cancer, which is the lining of the uterus. There are also cancers that involve the uterus that come from the muscle of the uterus, which are a group of cancers called sarcomas. And there's cancers which are a mixture of those things. So what I'm going to speak to you now is what I believe you're referencing, which is the lining of the uterus, which is endometrial cancer, which is, you're right, one of the most one of the best cancers to have of gynecologic cancers if you catch it early. But unfortunately, it's one of the most deadly cancers if you catch it late. It's even harder to treat than ovarian cancer when you catch it late. Endometrial cancer, though, has a heralding sign in over 80% of the cases where you actually have abnormal bleeding. And that's bleeding either in between your periods or bleeding after menopause. And if women are educated about that and pay attention to when they're having bleeding and not ignore it, even if it's just a little bit, even if it's likely not cancer, the fact is that that is the presenting symptom for most endometrial cancers. So going to your doctor and saying, hey, I haven't had a period for 5 years and wow, I just got a period. That's not normal. That needs to be evaluated. Endometrial cancer is also a cancer that has both a genetic component, which we're learning more and more about, but it also has a lifestyle component. And that lifestyle component is something that we alluded to earlier, which is obesity. In women who have extra adipose tissue, fat, that fat gets converted to estrogen in the peripheral bloodstream. That estrogen then acts on the lining of the uterus over time and causes growth. That growth becomes a precancer and ultimately a cancer. So obesity is both a cause of endometrial cancer, and it can also increase the chance that a cancer could come back once you've already had the diagnosis. So the good news about endometrial cancer is both that you can catch it early and cure it if you know to look for the signs, and also that you can take great strides in your life by modifying your health to both decrease the risk of getting it, or if you've had it, to decrease the risk of it coming back.
Great. Just a reminder, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media, talking today with Dr. Joni Mayer-Hope about gynecologic cancers. And we welcome you to join the conversation by calling us toll-free statewide. You'll be live on the air, 1-888-353-5752. You can also drop us an email at lineone@alaskapublic.org. So uterine cancer or endometrial cancer is the largest subtype of uterine cancers. How are these treated?
Well, it again depends a little bit on how they present. Uterine endometrial cancer is a surgically staged cancer. So what that means is that the way we figure out typically whether it has spread is by performing a surgery. And that surgery involves removing the uterus, cervix, fallopian tubes, and ovaries, and evaluating the lymph nodes that matter to the uterus. And that is particularly in women who don't already have signs that that the cancer has spread, like, say, through imaging, CAT scan imaging, or we don't know that the cancer has already spread. That surgery is performed minimally invasively, which is really, really has... and especially in when you're dealing with morbid obesity on top of a cancer diagnosis, being able to perform minimally invasive surgery has really revolutionized our capacity to get women safely through surgery and deal less with some of the wound healing complications that would come from a major open procedure. So ideally, the surgery is performed minimally invasively, and then after the surgery is done, then we can determine whether it has spread and what the stage is. Based on the stage, then we would decide whether any extra therapy is needed. That would be either radiation and or chemotherapy. But many times we catch it early and we can cure it with surgery alone.
Okay. So you have a new project focusing on ovarian cancer. Of the topics we're discussing today, ovarian cancer is really the toughest one, isn't it?
Ovarian cancer is tough because, unlike cervical cancer, where, you know, we could eradicate cervical cancer, we could end cervical cancer in Alaska with a shot, with a vaccination, which is just one of my goals.
I'm giving Dr. Mayer-Hope a thumbs up here. I can't see that on the radio.
Which is an amazing thing to be able to say, that we could actually eradicate a cancer with a vaccine, a safe vaccine. So whereas cervical cancer is something that we could absolutely prevent. And by the way, just to say, Australia may be the first country to completely eradicate HPV-related cancers because of how fantastically they've incorporated the vaccine program in their country. That's another discussion. And endometrial cancer is a cancer that you can have a symptom that's, you know, which is bleeding, that's very reliable for. Ovarian cancer is much, much, much more tricky because there is no Pap test, there is no vaccine at this point, and there is no reliable sign or symptom. And most of the time, almost 80% of the time even, we catch it once it's already in an advanced stage. So ovarian cancer becomes a very challenging cancer to treat.
Okay. So we're going to need to take a short break, and we'll come back and continue our conversation about ovarian cancer. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection, and we'll be right back.
Funding for Line One, Your Health Connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Things were just fine, life going good, career on my mind. One day woke up, felt a bit queasy, really uneasy. Began to lose weight, my belly blew up, and I just couldn't think. Is it acid reflux, a virus, a flu, or I'm just going nuts? Things got worse, so I went down to the clinic. Did a bunch of tests, hoping I was finished. Got the results, I was stunned, I couldn't answer. Doc looked me in the eye and said, "You have cancer." Cancer? What do you mean? I have family, plans, goals. My love, you were with me, right by my side. Acting really tough, trying hard not to cry. You said to be strong, we'll fight this head on. Take a leap of faith. And the journey's begun.
Any mountain you can name. I'll bet this life, I'll bet this fight's a steeper game.
Pretty, no, it ain't. Gonna tell it like it is. They took me to surgery.
All right. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection with Dr. Joni Mayer Hope. We're talking about gynecologic cancers. And that was a clip from a new project, Any Mountain, which focuses on ovarian cancer. Dr. Mayer Hope, you're really branching out with video and a hip-hop sound. That clip, I think, really captures the emotional impact of an ovarian cancer diagnosis, not just for the patient, but also for the entire family. I have to say, as a husband, father, and grandfather, I really love the inspirational call to men to support the women in their lives. So tell us a bit about Any Mountain.
Well, Any Mountain is a hip-hop song about ovarian cancer. This is an independent project of Let Every Woman Know and myself. It's not a No Evidence of Disease project. And it is a hip-hop song that tells a story of a woman going through ovarian cancer, and it takes her through the diagnosis, and it takes her through the treatment, and it takes her through the survivorship. And it basically mounts the challenge that any mountain you can name, I bet this fight's a steeper gain. And the other character in the song is the supporter character, the person who is next to that woman's side through all of those stages. I had the opportunity to record the song professionally in conjunction with several fantastic singers here. Kat Moore, Melissa Mitchell are two who we went to New York, and we recorded the song with a producer named Mario McNulty. And after which, I raised funds to make a music video of Any Mountain. And we now have the song and the music video, and we are in the process of designing an app called the Any Mountain app. And the Any Mountain app is going to be a very simple, user-friendly application for your smartphone, which will take you through a family history. And that's for men and for women. Basic history, asking questions about who's in your family and did they have cancer and what kind of cancer. And based on that, trying to figure out triaging the users to either a high risk or a low risk category. We believe that more than 20% of ovarian cancers are genetically predisposed. So if we could identify who those 20% are, then we could actually do something to prevent this heartbreaking disease. Once the triage is done, then it'll, by zip code, give the user access to genetic testing, genetic counseling, and informed providers in their area. Once we have that app, the song, and the video, we're going to launch a national campaign, the goal of which is going to be inspire 10 million people, raise $10 million, prevent ovarian cancer. In 2019, our hope is to launch this educational effort using the song and the video to raise a significant amount of funding to do something about ovarian cancer prevention.
When will this all be available?
I would tell you that it's going to be available in the latter half of 2019.
Okay.
Right now, we're working on the partnerships of with Let Everyone Know, with the national groups that have an interest in this cause as well. It's a really exciting project, and it really features Alaska, because what you haven't heard in this song is the 52 mountains that we list, trying to compare the fight against ovarian cancer with as many mountains as we could name. They're real women going through the disease who are featured in this film, as well as the talents of Underground Dance Company, which is an amazing community hip-hop dance organization here in town. So it blends both the talent of Alaska with the grandeur of Alaska with the cultures in Alaska. And the women who are fighting ovarian cancer all together in this video in a really compelling, powerful way.
And in the chorus, you name 52 mountains and really deliver it like a melodic machine gun. How did you learn to speak that fast? Did you work your way through medical school as an auctioneer?
No. But I practice a lot when I'm running. That's my secret. Yeah,
okay.
I'll get whatever I'm trying to learn and run it in my earphones, and I'm a committed runner, and so that's how I've spent many a run practicing 52 mountains in a row.
Well, there's certain parts of that sounds like some speed work as well. So we have some callers. We have a caller from that has specifically a question about herpes simplex virus and whether or not there's a risk of developing cancer associated with those infections. So welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Thank you. And that was my question, whether the HSV2 virus predisposes the person to any gynecological cancers.
Not that I know of.
And I'll put on my infectious disease hat and say not that I know of either. So thank you for that question. We earlier were talking about papillomaviruses, which are associated with a number of genital cancers, but we're not aware of herpes simplex virus being associated with the risk of cancer. So
I will say, though, that just as a segue, that when you do have a sore in that area, that it is important to get it evaluated, because if it's not a herpes lesion, the way that vulvar cancers present, which are not always but can be human papillomavirus related, is often with an ulcerated sore, itching, a lump or a bump that won't go away that you've noticed. These are things that should get checked out. Nothing to be embarrassed about. What I like to tell women is that you have to be an advocate for your own health, and that if you notice something that does not feel right to you, or that's new, or that's persistent, or you just have a question, please, please go and get it checked out, and don't take no, even if your health provider dismisses you and it's still worrisome to you, then take it to the next step. You have to be your own advocate in care in order to make sure that you're getting the best care.
Okay. I'd like to take another caller also from Southeast. Rebecca, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Thank you for taking my call today. I wanted to ask a question. I have a 12-year-old daughter
And I'm also a cancer survivor, a breast cancer survivor. And so getting her the HPV vaccine seemed like a total no-brainer to me because I didn't want her to have to go through that if I could prevent it. But I'm hearing a lot of discussion from a lot of my mom friends about how they feel it's really unsafe to get this vaccine for their daughters. And I just was wondering if you could speak on the safety of this vaccine.
This vaccine has been studied extensively, and the safety of it has been proven time and time again. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of misinformation about the vaccine that has really propaganda, if you will, that has caused for a lot of concern. But the HPV vaccine is truly a safe vaccine. I mean, it's the types of there's not a live virus that goes. It's a virus-like particle that causes an immune response that then enables you to fight the virus. They recommend that you get the injection while sitting down so that if you're scared of shots or that you don't have sort of a fainting response that's just related to needles, there can be pain at the injection site because you're, you know, injecting something into that area. But major, major studies, an enormous amount of data has been amassed proving the safety of the HPV vaccine.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today, Rebecca. So it's interesting. We listened to the first verse of Any Mountain, and you tell the story of someone who's experiencing ovarian cancer. I think it captures how vague the symptoms can be early on. But once that diagnosis is made, what are the treatment options for ovarian cancer?
If the diagnosis is made in an advanced stage, which it usually is, and by that I mean that the cancer has spread beyond the ovaries, usually into the lining of the abdomen. The ovaries are like chairs in a living room. It's like the abdomen is a big room and there's furniture in the room. And if you have a chair there, it's easy for something to move from one chair to the other, you know, or to the couch or off onto the table. You know, there's no walls, there's no doors there. So when cancer gets on the ovary, it can basically, move off the surface of the ovary and swirl around the fluid in the abdomen and then take root somewhere else. The treatment for ovarian cancer, advanced ovarian cancer, is a combination of chemotherapy and surgery by a gynecologic oncologist. And the timing of that chemotherapy and surgery would depend on the spread and the disease pattern of diagnosis. Usually it involves a major, major surgery where your goal is to remove any evidence of cancer anywhere that it is in the abdomen, the purpose of which is to leave the abdomen cancer-free by the naked eye, meaning you cannot find any element of cancer in the naked eye anywhere in the abdominal cavity by the end of that surgery. That would be deemed a successful debulking surgery for ovarian cancer. Followed by six cycles of chemotherapy. That could also be done where you start with chemotherapy first and you put the surgery halfway through the chemotherapy. And that's a decision that needs to be made in conjunction with the patient and her gynecologic oncologist.
Okay. So really the goal is no evidence of disease.
The goal is no evidence of disease at the end of that course of treatment. And almost 80% of the time we achieve that. Almost 80% of the time, even more than that, we achieve no evidence of disease at the end of surgery and chemotherapy. Ovarian cancer is exquisitely sensitive to chemotherapy. The challenge is that 80 to 90% of the time it will ultimately come back. And there's actually some new hope out there of strategies to maintain that remission longer than we've ever been able to maintain it before, in the form of newer drugs that have now are starting to be FDA approved. One of those drugs is called a PARP inhibitor. And so there's actually, you know, tremendous hope on the horizon that we're going to be able to extend survival. And, you know, I think that even looking towards cure, even in advanced ovarian cancer, is not out of the range of possible. You know, it's the concept of any mountain. The idea is either prevention or cure. It's climbing that highest mountain that you can imagine climbing. And it is doable. People get to the top of Everest. Okay. Well, people are going to be able to survive ovarian cancer. And that's the concept behind the vision that we're hoping to move forward with that project that we were talking about.
You're a bit of a mountaineer yourself, aren't you?
Well, when I have time, I certainly love to take a try at climbing.
I think I did get to see an advanced version of the video. It closes with a shot from the top of Everest. Was that a shot that you took, or was that from a friend?
That was definitely fun from a friend.
Okay. That
will never be me, but I'm so respectful of people who are able to do that.
I understand quite well. So we have about roughly 2 minutes left. What are the take-home messages from our discussion today?
Well, the take-home messages in my mind are that I hope that women are listening to this program and men who are listening to this program, are willing to ask questions and take a self-inventory both of their own histories, of their bodies, and seek help and get answers to the questions that they have. There are tremendous resources in this state. There's a fantastic medical community here. And so at least the preliminary and often the full treatment course can be accomplished close to home. There's no question that's not a good question when it comes to finding out if you're okay or if you're healthy. These are complicated cancers, and they're in an area that are not easy to talk about. So, be bold and get the answers that you need.
Yeah. So I think you've just really emphasized one of the important things for all of us is to be willing to talk about these issues. And I think you've really highlighted nicely the appropriateness of your name, Dr. Mayor Hope. There is a lot of reason for hope when we're talking about gynecologic cancers today. So, Dr. Mayor Hope, you're a figurative and literal rock star, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today, for sharing your medical knowledge as well as your musical skills. And thank you to all of you for joining us today on Line One. Next week, co-host Prentice Pemberton will be back for a discussion with Dr. Ann Kring of the University of California at Berkeley, and the topic will be schizophrenia. Dave Waldron produced today's program with sound engineer and reoriented the host when needed. Ammon Swenson edited our web content. This is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a happy and healthy 2019 and a healthful life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.